Hi, my name is Jim Lundy. I'm the Chief Technical Architect at the Microsoft Technology Center in Atlanta, Georgia.
And I'm Joe Baeza. I'm a technical architect from the MTC in Detroit. Jim and I are here today to talk about people-centric security. So people-centric security is really a way of implementing security so that IT gets to protect the organization in all the ways that are required, and that people can still be productive using the tools that IT gives them.
So Joe, certainly 2015 was a very turbulent year in terms of security. Data analysts tell us that 160 million customer records have been compromised, and across those breaches, each breach tends to cost close to $3 million for each one of those. The average time between when a hacker has breached your system and the time that it is detected for 2015 was 229 days, and that continues to go up. So Microsoft's unique perspective on this is largely due to our security footprint. Our cyber footprint within the industry affords us the telemetry from billions of logons and devices, services, both in our private and our public clouds. But also we combine that with machine learning, behavioral inspection, and human analysis to be able to detect and respond to what looks like anomalous behaviors in our customers' environments. Microsoft's commitment to trust is built on four key pillars. Privacy, the privacy of our customer, our corporate customers' data, in that not having access to it by our operators or by others is a key cornerstone of our delivery, and we never use it to target advertising at our users.
Yeah, we tell our customers, right, Jim? It's your data. We're just keeping track of it. We're just holding it for you.
That's right, Joe. The transparency that Microsoft affords through our cloud services to make sure that you have the appropriate amount of transparency in how your data is stored, how it's used, the security, privacy, and compliance practices and processes around that is intended to help protect your information. The third pillar for us is security. Certainly confidentiality, integrity, and the availability of your data that is secure at all times. Microsoft's cloud services are designed, implemented, and operated in such a way as to ensure that your data is secure. And then lastly, compliance. For us, making sure that you can meet your regulatory obligations and requirements, making sure that we provide you the information needed from certifications to be able to answer back to third-party audits is a key part for us.
So those are the challenges that all of our customers face. The ones that come into the MTC have very similar ideas about what their requirements are. And not the least of which is supporting what we call mobility solutions. So the ability to use any device, whether it's an iPad, whether it's a tablet or a phone, or just your normal PC that folks have been using for years, in a secure fashion and still be able to be productive with that device. So we break this down into three different categories. So identity and access management. Identity is the new control plane for controlling how people access their information. Microsoft gives users one set of credentials, one ID and password, and this gives IT the ability to actually put controls at the user, individual user level, to enable things like conditional access and multi-factor authentication to control where you access it from and how many extra steps you have to take to actually prove that it's you. We also give you a lot of reporting around those abilities so that you can see where somebody authenticated, where somebody logged in, and what device they were logging in with. You can also do things with mobile device and application management. So think about the old scenario where somebody would come into the office with a brand new tablet and they wanted to access corporate resources with it. In the past, it was you would enroll your device and have to give control over it, over that device to IT. And what that meant was if something happened and the device was compromised, they would wipe the whole thing. There was no concept of separating corporate data from personal data. Today, with mobile application management, we can take the applications that you use to access corporate data and separate those off from the ones that you use for personal information. What that means from a control perspective is devices that, or applications that access corporate data, can't communicate with applications that are not managed by the corporation. So security breaches are prevented because you can't copy from one environment to another. And it's all seamless to you as the end user. We might do something like ask you to put a PIN in. We at Microsoft have to do that, right, for any device that we use. But beyond that, it's really just a matter of saying, hey, I want to have access to it. Do what you need to do to my device, and then give me those capabilities to get my information. Beyond that, so also information protection. So the ability to take the things that you work with, PowerPoint presentations, Word documents, put a wrapper around those things, and enable us to track who authenticates to get access to that document, who takes the document home on a USB stick and opens it up, again, logging in with credentials that they have from the corporation. And we can track those things so that if they log in from some other location that's not normal, we can figure out that maybe that particular file has gotten into somebody's hands who shouldn't have access to it. And in a worst case scenario, actually revoke access altogether to that document so they have no access to the information whatsoever. And also with advanced security management, what we have is the ability to get visibility into how things are happening within the organization. So we have this capability to, so we have customers all the time who come in and say, I don't have cloud-based applications. I don't know if you hear this, Jim. Customers come in and say, we're not going to go to the cloud.
All the time.
Yep. And usually the thing we say back to them is, so are you using this particular service? Or are you using that particular service? And we have a tool now that will allow you to go and find out which software as a service applications you're using within your organization. So we can give you visibility into what used to be shadow IT in the form of a computer underneath somebody's desktop, the stereotypical, hey, that's the guy running the corporate application, the department application. Now it becomes much easier for people to do that kind of shadow IT by having a credit card, going up to somebody who gives them software as a service capabilities, and then just entering their credit card in and getting that service back into the organization. We can help you keep track of that. We can also identify risks that are happening within your organization. Are you having authentications that happen in places that are completely impossible? So if you think about the scenario where you're in Los Angeles and you authenticate, you log into the system, and you're in New York, and all of a sudden, 5 minutes later, you're in New York and you're logging in again. We can keep track of those things and say, hey, you know what? There's no way that Jim was in both places at one time. We can give you a quick call and say, hey, Jim, just wanted you to know that, you know, are you in LA or New York? And whichever place you're not, somebody else is using your credentials. If we can't get a hold of you, we can actually revoke that access, suspend your account, and until we can get a hold of you, make sure that nobody else is still using your ID and password to do things on your behalf that would show up and potentially get you and the corporation into trouble.
That's what Microsoft refers to as the impossible travel scenario.
So we can also reduce the surface, the attack surface that's available to people who want to do bad things in your organization. So if you have multiple ways to access different resources within Microsoft or within whatever organization you're in, we can minimize that down so that the only things you're having access to are the things that you use on a regular basis, the things that are critical to your job, rather than having your ID and password be able to be used for many things that we have to keep track of and also protect. So one of the things that our customers have come to us frequently with is e-discovery. The conversations that I have with customers usually focus on Office 365 and finding ways to keep track of the information they have in the system. And one of the things they struggle with the most is as requests come in for somebody who wants to understand what a particular user or what a particular department has done as part of a legal action is e-discovery. In the past, e-discovery was the process of sweeping up all the users and locations and different capabilities that are out there and putting them into a bin and doing some deduplication to make sure that you weren't getting multiple copies of the same thing and handing them over to the lawyers. All this was done in electronic format, of course. And the lawyers would then go through all of those things painstakingly, and lawyers are not cheap. They're worth every penny, but they're not cheap. So with advanced e-discovery, what we allow you to do is using some training of the system, use some of that intelligence as to what's relevant and what's not relevant, and then provide that to advanced e-discovery, and it'll give you back kind of a linear display of, depending on how much information you want to get, this is how much it'll cost you. If you want to get 100%, it's going to cost you this much money, If you want to get 60%, it's going to cost a lot less money. And then we let organizations figure out what makes the most sense for them in terms of how much information they want to bring back. The last thing we're going to talk about is something we call advanced threat protection. If you think about the vectors that the bad actors have used to get into organizations, attachments and links are two of the ways that are pretty commonplace these days. Even in the past, when we had viruses that would propagate via emails that went out, where someone would say the classic one is the $1 million that's unclaimed that you, Jim Lundy, can get a hold of if you'll just reply back to me. And there's a little attachment there, and you click on it, and bad things happen. So with advanced threat protection, what we allow you to do is, even for malware that hasn't been identified yet, is we will take that, push it off to the side in what we call a detonation chamber, which is basically a virtual machine, and we will open it up and let it do whatever it wants to the system in a safe environment that's not going to harm anybody, and then take some analysis of that to see whether or not it's a virus or not, whether it's malware or not. If it is malware, we can actually control what we do with it. Do we send the message through to the end user and give them some indication that, yeah, this was a bad thing that you were going to end up having to interact with? Or is it something that we're just not going to send the email at all, depending on what it was?
But you, as your organization, have control over what happens with that.
Yeah, so you, as your organization, have control over what happens to the actual malicious content, as well as how your users are notified about it. So again, that's the people-centric piece of this. You, as an end user, should never be surprised or go to your email and say, I don't know what that is. You should get a clear indication of, this is something that IT caught, and when you click on it, you'll see a message that says, this is a malicious file that you can't open and you can't view.
Correct.
So the other vector that people have used to come in, the bad actors again, are links. So you also get links. And if you ever, the standard practice has been when you mouse over a link, you look at the URL. If it's got an extension on it, a domain name that looks bad, and there are many that you don't want to open just because of where they come from, then you would just kind of ignore it. A lot of those things today end up in your junk mail because they come across in ways that make them very easy to identify as junk. But the bad guys are getting better, and they create emails that look official. They look like they're coming from Microsoft. They look like they're coming from your bank or from your financial institution. And part of that is taking that URL and kind of abstracting it away so that when you click on it, you're actually sent to a different destination. So with advanced threat protection, what we can do is when that URL comes in, we will rewrite it. We will actually take a look at whether URL is actually pointing. And if it's a malicious site, when you click on the link, we will give you a dialogue. You as a user will give you a dialogue that says, this is a malicious site. We recommend that you not continue to it. And if it's, we can make it optional for you. You can actually continue to it if you want to, but in more cases, it's usually better to just say, hey, you can't go through to this. So we protect you that way from malicious content and from malicious links.
Yeah, surely the number of emails that we get that have $1 million offers or the number of people that I have that are friends of mine from kingdoms all over the world indicates just how much of this information we're all receiving and the need for protection.
It's been a surprise to me how many people I know that actually have money to give me, yeah. And they have waited until now to contact me.
All right, so at this point, I think it's best if we start to look at some of the solutions that Microsoft has in our cloud service offerings to help us start to alleviate some of these concerns.
Yeah, so I mentioned a little bit earlier this thing we call advanced security management. And advanced security management is a way for us to kind of get ahead of some of the things that happen in the organization. So as an IT administrator, you have some ability to go in and put some controls into place that don't affect the user experience, but protect them from things that they need to be protected against that they may not be aware of. One of the easiest things to notice, one of the easiest things to detect, for instance, that an end user would have no knowledge of, is whether or not they've authenticated from multiple places at one time, the impossible time travel thing you mentioned earlier. I'm not going to know if somebody used my credentials to log in from the other side of the world because I'd have no way to know that.
And many times those are scattered across multiple devices, multiple places where we authenticate either in cloud services or on-premise, and it's almost impossible to pull that together.
Yep. So what we've done with ASM is allow you to create policies and then go in and set up alerts and different notifications that allow you to see what's happening within your organization that can be classified as an anomaly or some other type of threat. So in this case, if we look at what Don Harkey at Contoso.com has done, you'll notice that Don has actually logged into a session from an anonymous proxy, an IP address that's been set up to kind of mask where the actual request is coming from. What makes it worse is that Don is actually an administrator, and she's done some things with the environment that, you know, are bad. She set up a forwarding address so that email that comes to her will end up going to this other email address that is probably outside of the system. And she's actually done this 5 times in the recent past. I mean, these are a lot of different things, and 3 failed login attempts. These are a lot of different things that tell us there's probably something wrong happening here. Now, so what I want to do is, since I've identified as Dawn's ID as being problematic, I want to go ahead and suspend it so that I can reach out to her and say, hey, you know, just in case you're not aware, if you haven't seen some funny emails show up or something like that, there's some things going on that we think you need to know about. We need to figure out how to address them.
This scenario has all the hallmarks of a traditional compromise attack.
Yep. Oh, so one other stat to throw out there, Jim. You know, over 60% of the vulnerabilities that we've seen exploited have come about because of IDs and passwords that were compromised in some fashion. Mm-hmm. So the activity log that shows up here shows different activities that happened that kind of calculated that score that we associated with that threat that led us back to Don's ID and password being compromised. There's been quite a bit of suspicious activity that has occurred, and a lot of this has occurred seemingly associated with this IP address here, the one that we identified as being sort of a proxy, sort of an anonymous actor who's masking off people that are bad actors. So we're going to filter by that to see other activities that have happened coming from that IP address. And you'll notice quite a few things. And not only the number of things that are happening, but they're all the same type of activities. There's someone trying to authenticate against different IDs within Contoso, and usually failing because the ID and the password they have don't match what's actually in our directory. And you'll notice there are quite a few of them. Let's do something here and take a look at the failed logon for Jerry Neely. So Jerry had an invalid password activity happening, and it happened more than once. Certainly all of us are guilty of fat fingering our password here and there. That happens all the time, especially for a mobile device with a very small keyboard.
But not necessarily 5 times in a row.
But not 5 times in a row. That's kind of an indicator that there might be something else going on here with Jerry. When you add to that the fact that it's coming again from that IP address that's suspicious, that kind of makes us think there's something else that we should be looking at. So because it's a failed logon, we also want to see, hey, are there other IDs that are being compromised by this failed logon kind of activity? And turns out when we filter by that activity, there are a lot of other activities, and they're also all coming from that suspicious IP address. And as we scroll down, we just see more and more of them. So what we want to do is create a policy. And we want to create what's called an anomaly policy detection. So we're going to go ahead and create a policy. We're going to give it a name. And we're going to give it this name because we're looking for specific types of activity. When you think about the things that an end user can do versus what an admin can do, there's a lot of difference, right? So an end user has access to things that are in a very secure environment. An end user will only have certain permissions within that environment. So they can't access servers. They can't do things that IT would normally own. If they're an admin, they can pretty much do whatever, including making other people admins, including changing passwords, including all kinds of bad things. So we want to make sure to track those types of events. We want to assign a risk factor to those events so that when they happen, we can figure out which ones are ones that we should be concerned about. So we create the policy. We look at the risk factors, and we figure out which are the ones that we want to use to determine how wrong something is, if you will, how potentially dangerous something might be. We want to filter on selected activity, and then we're going to give it a filter. and we're going to filter by administrative activity. So just doing the whole thing I mentioned before, of just making sure that we are aware of what admin activity is happening in our environment. Impossible travel is the one that you mentioned earlier. Getting from point A to point B in an unbelievably fast amount of time. So we're also going to set a threshold. And what a threshold means is that when you given the risk factors that we define for this particular policy, how high does that threshold have to be for us to say, yep, that's one that we have to worry about? The default is kind of medium. It's a bad thing, but it might not be a really horrible thing. We probably still want to be aware of it, but it's not going to be something that we want to get alerted about. In this particular case, we're going to push it up to be an 85, which means we're pretty sure it's something we should be aware of. And then we're going to set a default alert limit. So after five alert limits, we just kind of figure out we have to go back and look at that thing a little more in detail.
So the solution will give you guidance on what you should do, but you have full capability to control all the configuration in the policy.
Absolutely. So it's an important thing we've heard from customers. If you think about data loss prevention, for instance, one of the biggest complaints that we've heard about the DLP solutions that are out there is they give a lot of false positives. And it's not so much that they don't want to catch the things that are happening in the system that need to be managed differently. They don't want to be bothered by a lot of noise, right? They just want the actual activities that are happening where somebody did share a social security number or something like that versus something that might have been one. With the threshold, we can adjust it so we're not capturing as many of those things that might not be really bad things, and we're focused on things that are much more likely to be actual things we should be worried about.
It helps you with the administrator fatigue issue that we run into when the bell's going off all the time.
Absolutely, right? It's the boy who cried wolf thing.
Yeah.
So we can also set up email addresses and text messages. So multiple ways that you can make people aware that these things are happening. And these alerts go out to those folks as well. So Exchange Online Protection is another way that we enhance the security picture within Office 365. And one of the things that we did was to take a look at existing capabilities and then build upon those and also add new ones. So one of the ways that we build on existing capabilities is to protect your organization from spam. So spam's been around for a while, and there have been different spam filtering solutions. And one of the controls that you have around the spam filtering solution in Exchange Online is how much email actually gets detected as spam and gets sent through to your users. So the threshold is what the control that we use to control how much of that email is identified as spam and then gets moved to the junk mail folder and how much is let through as if it was normal email. The higher the number, the higher the amount of email that goes through to your end users. So you just want to adjust that and explain to your end users about their email, where it's coming from, and get feedback from them about what's being caught and what's being let through. What we can also do is filter out based on IP addresses. So using the connection filter, we can allow IP addresses to send us email, and we can also block IP addresses from sending us email. Microsoft actually goes beyond just giving you the capabilities to control this. We give you an IP list that has been identified as being benign, and you can use that to kind of decide what email you can also accept. Now, on the malware side, you can detect malware that's been identified that you already know about and do things to let your end users know about email messages that contain that malware. You can actually delete the attachment and use the default alert text for your end users to see. And you can send notifications to administrators both for email that's sent inside the organization and email that's sent from outside the organization. Differentiating the two, where stuff that's sent internally is going to be a little bit more critical because that stuff's going to fly around your organization because it's already inside of it. Externally, you have other ways to control email that's coming in from outside the organization. So when you think about the enhancements that we've made beyond Exchange Online Protection, beyond spam, beyond that filtering, something called safe attachments. The two vectors that are most commonly used to get bad stuff into your organization are attachments and links. And we have something called safe attachments. So with safe attachments, this is for malware that hasn't been identified yet. There's an attachment that comes through, and we're not sure if it's good or bad yet. So we can take that attachment, separate it from the email message, move it into a virtual machine, we call this a detonation chamber, open up that attachment and see what it does to the system. If it does things that are bad to the system, it's going to be identified as malware, so that subsequent messages that contain that malware will also be blocked. And then we can decide how we notify the user that the message that came in had something bad in it. So typically there'll be a little footprint of the email message, and when they click on it, they'll say this attachment was bad and you're not going to be able to actually open it or view it. We have different controls that we can put on that, but the intent being let the user know that message came through, it was detected as being bad, so we're not going to pass it along to you. And then we can also notify people within the organization that we found that bad attachment. So another way that bad information has come into the system is through something called our links. And we have something to address this called SafeLinks. And what SafeLinks does is, based on URLs that come into the system, we will take a look at that URL and see has it been identified already as being a bad URL. And for all the URLs that come in, we will rewrite those. We're going to rewrite them in a way so that if you click on it, we will actually not take you directly to the link that you're clicking on. We'll take a look again to see if the URL that it's actually going to is a bad URL. If it's a bad URL, we'll pop up a screen and let you know you shouldn't go to this site and prevent you from doing it. If it's a good URL, then we'll go ahead and pass you through as if it was a normal one. But we will rewrite all of them. We'll also give the ability to track which URLs come into the system, who clicks on them, and what happens when they click on them. We'll also give the ability to actually say there have been some URLs that are saved, so let's not rewrite those. Now, the end user experience, I'll show you here, is Sarah Davis. So Sarah is somebody who has a lot of email, like the rest of us do, and she's in her browser, and she notices this file called keys.js. It's a JavaScript file, and when we scan that with the safe attachments capability, what we did to her email message was to kind of put this little universal symbol for do not open this or this is a bad thing. When she clicks on it, because Sarah's curious about what that thing is, it says, hey, we've blocked access to this, and you're not going to be able to view that attachment either. The intent, again, is people-centric security. We're going to let her know something's wrong with this, and we're going to give her enough information to figure out, hey, this is something that she should probably not be clicking on. In addition, with the safe links capability, where we have an email message that came from Alex Darrow, and it says cheap flights, always a bit of a key to let you know that something's not going to be good, is the title of the message. When you click on that site URL, what happens is the system says that's a bad URL that it's pointing you to, it's been identified as malicious, and we won't let you go to that URL. The cool thing about this is even within the same message, we can detect which URLs are good and which ones are bad. The one that says site in the email message is good. The one that says I Bing do you is good. So when I click on it, I actually go to Bing as I normally would expect to. So beyond those capabilities of being able to have users see what's going on with the stuff they're doing, we can also keep track of these URLs. And we can do a URL trace to see what people have clicked on. And we can base this on a time range, we can base this on recipient, and we can actually base this on the URL itself. In this case, what we'll walk through real quickly is filtering out all the URLs that Sarah clicked on. So we'll add her as a recipient, and then we'll click on search, and then what'll happen is we'll get back all the URLs that Sarah clicked on over the last 7 days. So Jim, that's just some of the tools that we give IT in order to make sure that the information within the organization is protected the way that it needs to be protected, as well as ensuring that users can have a good positive experience with those tools and get their jobs done every day.
Thanks for showing that to us, Joe, and thank you all for joining us today.